You're listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 435. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam Lloyd. I'm recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. And I'm a little bit scared, folks, because I skipped a week. I took last week of the show off. And you know why I took last week of the show off? Was for you, the listener. Because we got in this, I don't want to say it's a habit. It was more of a horrible unending rut of having like six shows recorded and in the can, but not releasing any of them. So I realized that, you know what, I only have 1 hour of my life a week in which to do anything that I want to do that's for me. So I'm going to, instead of talking to John and Tom this week, I'm going to go edit some fucking episodes. And I did that. And today is the day when at least three of those will have landed in your feed at the same time in this giant, like, 4 hour unceremonious blob that is, I'm sure, eating up all your disk space and forcing everything else into the trash bin. And on the one hand, I'm sorry that we had to do that to you. But on the other hand, I'm not sorry. There's your episodes, you jerks. So joining me on tonight's show, after being, you know, let free in the asylum last week, Mr. John Gentile.
Adam, we're like Prince, but with podcasts. We've just got archives and archives of unreleased amazing material that people are dying to have, but we're not letting out. Unrelated, man, have you guys seen this cheese challenge where people throw cheese at their babies' faces? This is like so messed up and people think it's funny. Like how is child abuse? Like, I really do think like humanity is becoming more crass and more savage and is devolving as Bob Casale said, and Mark Mothersbaugh said, like, how is throwing cheese at a baby and upsetting the baby funny in any context at all? You know, not to mention over the past couple of years, there's been more and more of these videos on Facebook of like little kids like getting on like slides and falling off and crying, like little kids getting injured or hurt, and people think this is hilarious. This is not funny. This is really not funny. You two have kids. Do you guys agree with me that this is insane?
No, I think it's hilarious. Well, listening to watching children cry is like an elixir to us, John. Once you have kids of your own, you'll appreciate it.
That's Tom Trauma, by the way, also on the show. John, are you shitting me? Is this a thing?
No, this is a thing, and people are literally divided over this. Some people think it's funny and cool, and some people think it's horrible. I think so what happened, like a week ago or so, like some guy said it's attack. Like he did a stupid YouTube video or Twitter video or something. He's like, it's attack of the cheese, and he threw a slice of, you know, American cheese. Adam, what do they call American cheese in Canada? Just out of curiosity.
There's a dog in the show. I think I'm wrong about this, but when you say American cheese, what I am picturing are those like nuclear yellow, like square,
yeah, piece individually of cheese, wrapped.
Individually wrapped in plastic, right? Now,
and yeah, if you look on the package, it actually says cheese product, not contains zero right. cheese. It's
so,
like oil
so we,
flavored.
We have cheese, we have that oil. We have that thing in Canada. Mm-hmm. It's up here, like I don't know, like Kraft would make them, right? So you would get
yep,
they'd be like Kraft
too.
Singles, right? And yep. I think like in our stores, it'd be called Kraft Singles, but they wouldn't call them American cheese up here because it's sort of like a freedom fries thing. Like, we don't call anything that's American American up here because no
so,
one wants
so anyways,
it. Right? But as I understand it, American cheese itself is like a product that is not exactly the same thing. And if you were to go to the States and get American cheese, it is its own distinct entity that is not that. But I'm unsure if that's true.
Well, there's Velveeta and there's Kraft, which is like fake cheese. But I mean, American cheese is actual real cheese, 100% cheese. If you get it, you know, American. Anyways,
like government cheese.
So on Twitter, this guy like he's like, it's attack of the cheese, and he throws a piece of cheese at his baby, and it smacks the baby in the face, and the baby gets upset. And people thought this was like hilarious, and then like a whole bunch of other people started throwing videos of them throwing slices of cheese at their babies. I'm not even kidding. This is real. This is not like a joke. Like, this is real. This is, and people think this is great. This is messed up.
I'll tell you what, you get a little pepper jack in your eye, it burns. Burns real bad.
But I mean, this is like child abuse, right? Like, this is messed up, right?
I don't know, John. I think you're taking it too seriously.
When you have a baby, it is...
And anyway, what are you watching? I mean, I've never seen this.
Well, see, so this actually makes me feel really good about two things. No, I never did this, but I probably...
I think my dog is dying.
Is it because you threw something at it and it ate it, or...
No, my dog loves cheese.
No, so... on the one hand, I understand the impulse to throw cheese at your children, because children are horrible, and babies are horrible, and all babies do is destroy your ability to sleep and have a moment to yourself. So
for making me drive a minivan. Take that.
Yeah, right. So I absolutely get the impulse to throw cheese at your children, and I don't know if I can necessarily fault that. I wouldn't throw maybe a brick of cheese at them. Now, what I am against maybe is using your children for amusement and then posting that on the internet so that you can score like influencer points from other douchebags. That's maybe not cool. But if you, in the privacy of your own home, want to throw a light, non-dense, non-brick sized piece of cheese at your children, I absolutely encourage it. Fine, go right ahead.
I can't agree with that, but I really can't agree with causing misery on your child for web hits.
Yeah, yeah. Like, don't do it for like Instagram likes or anything, but you know, if you're all sitting around as a family and your kid is sitting there and they're looking at you and they didn't let you sleep all night and you want to like toss some cheese at them, I'm okay with that. I'm not going to call the child protection or anything on you. I might call the dairy board, but the part that really makes me happy about this is I still literally do not know if you made this up, and that means that my new method of using the internet is resoundingly successful, which is that instead of looking at Instagram
discogs,
yeah, exactly.
No, instead of looking at Instagram or looking at YouTube or Facebook or any of those things, I just watch episode after episode of Deep Space Nine on Netflix.
Oh, I've been watching TNG. I just saw the one where there's a Klingon civil war and Gowron whips everyone's ass again. Gowron's the best.
So this is great. So like I have all the benefits of wasting my time on the internet, but I don't have to deal with any of these assholes throwing cheese at their babies, and I don't even know it exists. So I feel like I've cracked the code. Like when you know Tim Berners-Lee and whoever else, you know, invented the web, what were they thinking of using it for? They weren't thinking about using it for the Bird Box challenge or throwing cheese at your kid on Instagram or, you know, making the Jenners rich or anything like that. What they wanted was for you to watch unending episodes of Star Trek, because those guys are fucking nerds. So I really feel that I'm being true to the spirit of the beast. Anyways,
well, I just don't know.
What'd you guys do last week?
Oh, probably went to some shows.
No, I mean like on the show stuff that I wasn't on.
Oh, it's basically a 1 hour long Adam White diss track.
Oh. we rapped.
I'm like, what'd you do last week? Well, you know, I had some kids stuff, and the podcast thing, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the normal thing, Adam, it was just very American-centric.
I really like Tom Klein. My name's Tom Trauma, and Adam sucks. Listen to this rap, you mother. It was great.
Well, my name is Tom Trauma, and I'm here to say I hate Canada in every single way.
I look forward to not posting that episode for several months. Okay, yeah. Do you have any mail before we get going?
We got some good mail. This is from James from Oklahoma. And this is what James from Oklahoma says. Every time you guys beat on Weezer, I die a little inside. Weezer was my high school soundtrack when I had no friends. They were there when I needed them, so I'm here when they need me. Sure, the new stuff isn't as good as Pinkerton or the Blue Album, but it's still better than most music on the radio. Do you really think Cardi B or Extension is better than this? You want every Weezer album to be the best one ever, but no band has done that before. Not even the Ramones. Even the Ramones have bad albums. I'm asking as a Weezer fan.
They didn't have a Weezer Black album, bad album.
I'm asking as a Weezer fan, give them another chance. James from Oklahoma.
No. I feel I've got my bona fides here. Like the Blue Album was the first CD that I ever purchased. So they were my teenage band too. I get that. I will fully cop to dismissively not listening to their new records just because I am so I'm so just righteously offended by the goof rock band that they've become. And I'll absolutely
plus,
admit.
Plus, you had friends in high school, so you didn't need to cling to Weezer so tightly, right?
Not really. I clung to Weezer a lot. But I fully capitulate that there are probably cool songs that are on those records that I am not listening to because I can't stomach the goof rock. But my Weezer ire is not born of malice. It's because I feel that I've been scorned. I've been disappointed by Weezer, and I am saddened, and I can't go there. So it's complicated. I mean, if you want to like Weezer, that's fine. But I will not give the one thing I don't want to give them, and it was what the letter writer asked for there, is I don't want to give them like, well, it's better than like most of the music that's out there. I mean, like maybe it's better than like a bunch of really obvious stuff that's in a different genre that's on the radio that you don't like. But there's a fuck ton of music out there, and I'm just at this point where like I don't need to wade through Weezer's like goof rock tracks to search for some gems when there's like 300 better records that are just objectively better that I'm never going to get through. You know, I won't get through 100 of them in a year. So I don't know why Weezer needs my time at all. Like, you know.
And anyway, saying it's better than what's on the radio is way too low of a standard. Right? I mean that's kind of what you said.
Like, but like letter writer, please like don't let us get you down on this. Like if Weezer is your bag, then like righteously be a Weezer fan and like, you know, you should do that. Don't let anyone stop you, but I ain't gonna do it.
I mean, I agree. I mean, I'm bagging on Weezer, but you know, whatever you're into, dude, it's fine. I'm not going to come to your house and make fun of you as you sit in your room and listen to Weezer because you live in Oklahoma. If you were closer, I'd consider it.
I'm well, maybe not you, but like John, you and me, we're the Windows 95 generation.
I thought you were going to say you're closer to Oklahoma.
No, I was like, going to say when like the fact that the Buddy Holly video was on the CD-ROM that had Windows 95 on it was a fucking mind blowing technical feat. Like there are all sorts of ways that Weezer is like inextricably linked into my.
I don't think that John has your enthusiasm for it, but maybe I'm wrong.
Do you not remember that? It was amazing. You had a little shiny disc that actually had not only all your computer stuff on it, but randomly this cool ass Weezer video. It was great.
I remember when it was crazy when computers first started had the ability to like play like video playback. There was like this race car game that came with Windows 95 where you like raced in the future. No one cares about this. Anyways, listen, this is from Dallin. Dallin says, what do you think about encores? Why do bands do them? From Dallin.
Say again. Would you repeat
encores,
that, Jess?
Encores. What do you think? Is it a farce? Is it just a part of the tradition? What do you think?
I don't know. I think there was a time where it had more significance because you hear about these like, man, when MC5 played the Grand Ballroom in 1968, they got called back out for 5 encores. You know, I think it maybe had some significance, but now it's pre-planned. You know, you can just go on the, what is it, Setlist.fm or Setlist, whatever the thing is, where you look at the set list and like, oh, I see what they're doing for their encore. It does. Yeah, there's no spontaneity to it anymore. It's just something that's sort of expected, at least at a certain level. I mean, you still go to a punk show at a dirtbag club. There's generally no encores.
Yeah.
But if it's like a ticketed event, chances are pretty good they got a planned encore.
If the band gets off stage by basically stepping one yeah. foot from where they were, yeah. and now they are among the crowd, they ain't getting back to playing encore, yeah. right? And I feel like that's mostly my world right now. But like the last like big ticketed show I was at, you know, there was definitely, you know, the big encore that came out, but this was it felt like it was part of the tradition at that point. Like this was like the last show on the Dirty Nails record release tour where they were in Toronto, where they were playing like a pretty big venue that was sold out, sea of people there, and they were doing they were doing an obnoxious big rock show with like huge lights and smoke and confetti and all this shit was going on. So, you know, if they're gonna basically like cosplay that they are, you know, Def Leppard or something like that, then I totally get how, you know, yeah, leave stage, have all the crowd cheer and go crazy for a while, and then come back. I mean, that's part of the whole fun, I think, of doing that kind of show. Also, I get that, like, you know, you might just have to pee. Like, I imagine that's what 90% of what happens.
Here's the question with the Dirty Neil show, Adam. Did they clearly save one or two of their most popular songs that they didn't play during their regular set? Or is it one of those things where they get on stage and sort of make awkward eye contact with each other and go, oh, what are we going to play?
I'm sure it was planned. Like, I don't think they spontaneously picked the songs out of the air that they were going to play at that point. I'm too in it with the Nil to know what their popular song is right now. What I mean by that is that the song that was their most popular song, that was their encore song when I was first into them, is now no longer that. It's now like a middle of the set kind of song. So something
which was that?
That Fucking Up Young, which was their first single that anyone cared about. But if you went to see them play in a bar like 5 years ago, like that was the song that they would have ended with and that like the crowd was all screaming along to. That was the song that like Fat Mike famously heard and got him into the band when they were kind of like courting Fat Wreck for a while. So that was always like the song. But now that's sort of like a middle of the set song because, you know, everyone that's in the room to see them these days, like that wasn't the big single that they grew up with. It was something off one of their actual studio albums. So. Yeah, so I don't know. I can't really tell on the Nil at that point. I will give one of my coolest concert going experiences though was an encore song because it I'm sure it wasn't, but it felt very spontaneous in the way that it played out, and it felt spontaneous in that I didn't know it was coming and like I couldn't have anticipated that it would have played out that way. So back in, I don't know, like 2004, 2005, something like that. The Constantines were touring with the Weaker Thens and with Andre Ethier, who is the lead singer of the Deadly Snakes. So they had played in Toronto and they had all, and the Cons finished their set. And I think the Cons played last and not the Weaker Thens. But anyway, so they all finished their set and they left. So then they came back for an encore, but instead of just the Cons coming back for an encore, like everybody came back for an encore. Like all the members of all the bands that were playing got onto stage together at the same time. And they played a cover of End of the Line by the Traveling Wilburys. And they kept throwing verses to various members of the bands that were on stage. And it was just like, it was magical because I was just, you know, here's all my favorite guys from all my favorite bands forming one super band for like 3 minutes to play this song that is sort of the perfect song for that setting because it has a whole bunch of vocalists in it. And, you know, that was one of those things that, you know, you couldn't have done that as anything but an encore. So if you're going to pull some really special shit, then hey, by all means, do the whole encore dance about it.
I will say some bands actually do real encores. Well, Peter Murphy of Bauhaus, like if he doesn't think the audience deserves it, he won't do an encore. And that like really pisses off the audience sometimes, which I think is kind of cool. Like if he thinks the audience does deserve it, he'll come out and actually do the encore. I think encores are drag if they're like pre-planned and it's just like, you know, AC/DC doing Back in Black. It's like, we knew you were going to play it. This is, you know, not a big deal. But if it's something like weird and special, then I love the encore. I saw Effed Up come out with Jello Biafra in San Francisco and they did the Ramones. And while they were, I think it was Blitzkrieg Bop, but it might have been Sheena as a punk rocker. While they were singing, this naked guy runs up and jumps on Damien Abraham's back and is like swinging around him. And Jello starts spanking the guy while singing the Ramones. That's a pretty good encore. You know what I mean? So I say if it's fitting, I dig it. If it's manufactured, we'll skip it.
That's fair.
You can always use the podcast at punknews.org.
All right, should we play a song before we get rolling here?
Yeah.
All right. You want to go? You want me to do it?
If you got one, play it on out, Adam.
Yeah, okay, sure. So this past weekend, I snuck up to Toronto so that I could see Tough Age play in a tiny little bar in Kensington Market. And Tough Age, I've talked about them here and there. They're one of my favorite bands at the moment. And so the show, they played, and they're all headed into Japan in the next week. So this was sort of like their like last little hometown gig before they go play 2 or 3 weeks in Japan. So Tough Age played before them. Vanity Phase played, and we did a song by them on the, I think on the podcast, but maybe, but on Punk News, definitely. They were that, that Gary Newman style, new age thing that we were playing with a few weeks ago, John.
New wave.
Just like, yes. Yanni was not there. And so the band that opened for the whole kit and caboodle was a band called Human, which is to say H-U-G-H space M-A-N. It is a kind of one of these Devo influenced, super quirky, weird punk bands that is, you know, playing yelpy, strange music with bizarre lyrics that are all short songs that are all sort of irreverent. And you're never really sure if anything is serious about the set, but it's kind of wonderful in how just bonkers it is. So Human was there. I'd yet to see them live, but I'd heard a whole bunch of their stuff online. And my favorite song that they played, and it's one of my favorite songs by them, is a song off of their latest tape. It is called Dynasty Destiny. The tape that this is on is called, and this is just fits in with the weirdness of the band. The tape is called Are We Dancer, but not Are We Dancer. It's like R space We space Dan, the proper name, comma, Sir, question mark, if you're trying to Google this. So this is Human with the song Dynasty Destiny off of Are We Dancer? And you should go look this thing up because it's super weird. Here we go.
Hello, son, are you there? It's your father calling. This will be my third call in as many months.
Dynasty Destiny. 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 My son won't talk to me. My son won't talk to me. My daughter calls me daddy. Well, she used to call me daddy. My third wife hates me. My second wife hates me. My first wife hates me. And my son won't talk to me. He's ruining his legacy. He's ruining his destiny. My son won't talk to me. And he's ruining his dynasty. He's not my boss. You see that my son won't talk to me. And he's ruining his legacy. And he's ruining this dynasty. My son won't talk to me. My son won't talk to me. My daughter calls me daddy. She used to call me daddy. My third wife hates me. My second wife hates me. My first wife hates me. And my son won't talk to me. Well, what was the point in playing for school? I let it go and learn those all my rules. Money isn't the end. You see, when you have a clear cut destiny, you're ruining my legacy. You're ruining my legacy. Well, who's gonna run my hardware store if I don't have a son anymore?
All right, we're back. I guess we're talking about records because that's what we do. The Record Store Day list was released, John. Are you aware of this?
I hope I am. I typed up the article, Adam.
So the 2019 Record Store Day is about to go down. It is on we should know the date for this. April 13th, right? So April 13th is when it's going to happen. There are going to be reissues that are going to show up from the likes of David Bowie, Frank Black, Cheap Trick, Devo, as we had just talked about, Hawkwind, and Iggy Pop. Plus, there's a whole bunch of various punk and punk adjacent bands that are releasing, maybe not necessarily new, but let's say unreleased or unique material for the set. So you have Generation X are issuing a new mix of Your Generation. Elvis Costello is putting out a new EP. The Menzingers are putting out a 7-inch that has a pair of B-sides from their last studio album. The Ramones are releasing yet another live album. There's a couple studio demos from Joe Strummer that are coming out on a 2-song 12-inch. Ska punk band The Interrupters are releasing a 3-inch record of She's Kerosene. And similarly, we have 3 inches coming out from Bad Religion with their new My Sanity single, and Rancid with a 3-inch version of Ruby Soho. Really, really scraping the bottom of the barrel there, Rancid. So there's a whole the whole list can be found, you know, on the internet. You guys can go take a look. So I guess a couple questions out of this. First of all, is there anything on here that's going to get you in the Record Store Day line? And the second thing is, like, what's with all these 3 inches?
Well, go ahead, Tom.
I see that they're, I'll let John answer, but I see that they're actually putting out these tiny little record players specifically that all they play are these 3 inches, which I assume you can only get one song on each side unless there's some technology is changing dramatically. I mean, who knows? Maybe they figured out a way to do it, but this it's ridiculous. I mean, it's retarded.
Are there tiny record players for this?
Yeah, they're making them, dude. They're like the size of my Walkman. And I think you can play them on a standard thing, but you know, those of us who have automatic turntables, I mean, my freaking automatic turntable doesn't even have a setting for 10 inch, let alone a freaking 3 inch.
Anyway, hey, fun sorry, fact. Jack,
go ahead.
Did you know there was a time before records were standard where every company that put out records played them at their own speed and they had their own size, and then there was a standardization, I think, in the 20s or 30s. So there was like all these weird times. Like,
so like if you had an RCA Victrola, you could only play RCA records, probably.
Right, and it played at like 55 where someone else would play like 47. It was like weird. And actually,
dude, maybe like a Menzinger's record, if you played it at like 55, maybe it wouldn't be too bad.
Hold on here. Let's clarify a couple things I just found on the internet. So
the Menzingers play faster than I thought.
Okay. So yes, there is a 3-inch record player that is coming out. It's actually coming out in conjunction with Record Store Day, and I'm going to get super nerdy here and be like, Crosley, so who gives a shit?
Oh, so it's going to sound terrible anyway. The needle's a piece of garbage.
Yeah, right. You shouldn't ever use a Crosley because they actually damage your records. You really shouldn't use those Crosleys.
Yeah, so it is.
They cost like $69, and they come with a cassette deck and an FM stereo and their own speakers and software for downloading your records, John.
Yeah, so the three inch Crosley turntable, which I will give it, is kind of adorable. They are selling these things for $70. It
same price as a full size one with a stereo.
It's powered over USB, or you can put batteries in it. It has a headphone out jack and a built in speaker. Here's the thing: it is a built in speaker. It is a tiny little thing and a built in speaker. I can't imagine that, like, you know, there is not a proper, or I'm assuming that there is not a proper high quality needle on this thing. Like, this whole thing is not meant for real world use.
I guess I didn't realize that Crosley was the, I didn't realize they were the only ones making it.
Well, they're definitely the ones making it in conjunction with this year's Record Store Day. So it probably makes sense then why all of a sudden everyone has a bunch of 3-inch records coming out. I mean, if you want to make inches,
it's ridiculous though.
It is ridiculous. I don't have a problem with it, with having like a strange sized record, so long as it is, you know, smaller than a 12 inch, because like, I don't know, my turntable, it's not automatic. So I'll put the arm wherever the fuck it needs to go. Right.
I mean, I can do that too. It's just nice. Oh, the automatic is nice.
But this is I don't know. It's kind of goofy. It's kind of, I mean, it's, it seems like the kind of thing that
I have a 5-inch. Do you guys have a 5-inch?
Yeah, there was a company labeled the Live on the Five. I know, like Dropkick Murphys had a live 5-inch record.
I have a 5-inch record of not the Ramones, but Joey Ramone's solo. I think it's Green doing Merry Christmas, I Don't Want to Fight Tonight. Mm. And it's a 5-inch record. And it also comes with like this little hanger so you can hang it on your Christmas tree if you want. That's the only odd size thing I have, other than a couple of cutout things that are sort of weird. But
what I don't like is that this whole thing smacks of like, you can just see the coordination, right? Okay.
You think the Rancid and the Crosley people are in bed together, Adam?
Yes, because all these 3 inches,
we're blowing this wide open.
Boy. Yeah, well, all the 3 inches are all on Epitaph related. You know, they're all Epitaph related bands, as far as I can see, that have these things coming out. And Crosley, of course, has this thing coming out in the same day as Records Store Day. I'm not saying it's a conspiracy. I'm just saying it's corny.
Well, yeah, it's corny and it's stupid. I mean, the frustrating. I mean, on Record Store Day, I give it thumbs up or thumbs down pretty much every year. This one, I got to give a mild thumbs down. There's nothing here that's really thrilling to me, which that's all right, because I honestly don't need to be spending the money. I've been spending a lot of money on records in 2018. I can cool my jets in 2019. But a couple of main things to point out here. The frustrating thing with Rancid is Rancid has a lot of unreleased and rare material that's really good. Namely, the what was the band they were in with Vic Ruggiero? The Silencers. There's an entire Silencers demo album that is as good a recording as an actual album that they could just put out and it would be fantastic and everyone would love it. They don't do that. They've got a ton of rare B-sides they could put out that everyone would love it, but they don't do that. There's a rare promo CD of Radio Havana, which we talked about before, which has an alternate version of Radio Havana. Slap that on a 7-inch and put it out. I mean, that's so much more interesting and worthwhile your money and a better way to pay tribute to a band than here's something everyone already has, but now it's 3 inches. It's almost like an agitprop art piece, if you will. Like, it's insulting the consumer so much. Like, we know you're going to buy whatever shit you give up, whatever shit we put out. So we know you know this is shit, and we know you're going to buy it anyways. So here you go. Here's a 3-inch record.
Well, that remains to be seen whether or not people will buy it, but
people buy this. I do think record store days, sales days are declining, though, because I definitely don't see as many people there now as I did five years ago. It was insane. Now it's just kind of like, you know, people show up, but it's not like insane. The Ramones live album, that's cool. They're basically just putting out live vinyl versions of the live CDs from the Ramones Mega Deluxe reissues, and I think that's okay, and that's cool. And also, you can just buy the record if you want to spend $7 on the Mega Deluxe edition just to get the live CD. Unfortunately, the Joe Strummer thing is kind of a bummer. I think as the Joe Strummer compilation, Strummer 001 proof, we're at the bottom of Joe Strummer material. I think anything that's worthwhile, we've scraped out. That compilation, I meant to do a review, and I probably will eventually, but that compilation was a real bummer. It's just like boring sketches of songs, and they go nowhere. And I said this is a mega Clash fan and as a big Joe Strummer fan. And so now they're going to charge $25 for three other demos that weren't even good enough to make it on their kind of boring demo compilation. So I think with Strummer, there's a lot of good live recordings. Put some of that out. We don't need What do we need $25 for three demos for that aren't even that good?
Well not even that. I mean, there are full albums of Strummer stuff that are just hard to get. So, like, if you want, like, put, you know, do just a proper vinyl reissue of Earthquake Weather or of the Walker soundtrack. And, like, I would buy those just because I want them, right? Like, there's an artist where, you know, you have a fan base and you have material that, like, is not readily available. And that's, you know, it's almost the opposite of the, you know, Rancid putting out Ruby Soho problem. Yeah, like all of it smacks as lazy. The Ramones thing is lazy, right?
Oh, yeah, but I mean, the Ramones isn't that bad of a crime because they're putting out something on vinyl that's never been on vinyl.
Yeah, you know? it's not as lazy, but it's in the lazy ballpark, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
Like with Joey, there are some excellent bootlegs of him doing live shows. That you could clean that up a little bit and put that out as a record, and that'd be fantastic, you know. And it's not that much work, you know. I mean, so I guess it is just laziness, or maybe people don't want like an obscure Joey Ramone live album. They kind of just want Blitzkrieg Bop again, but this time it's on 3 inches. We'll find out, you know.
You know, we've talked about this before, guys, but it's a little off the beaten path, my stupid dog. But, you know, I always wonder, you hear that, hey, the Sex Pistols album finally went platinum after 30 years or whatever. And you're like, did it really go platinum, or did like 300,000 of us each buy four copies of it because I bought it so many times over the years? And that's kind of the case with those Ramones albums too, you know. It's like, well, I had that first Ramones album on tape, and now I got it. I had it on CD Deluxe, and then I had the vinyl reissue. And it's like, I don't know.
Oh, one other thing I got to point out, man, this – everyone knows I'm a mega Stooges fan, mega Iggy Pop fan. This Iggy Pop reissue, it is garbage. They've done this a couple of years in a row now. They're putting out, I think it's called Paris 77. Paris 77 is one of these semi-legitimate but now legitimate live recordings that was out on Bomp.
I was going to say, it sounds like a Bomp release.
Yeah, I saw the CD version for like $9 like 3 or 4 years ago. I'm like, oh, check it out. This is cool. The sound quality, they shouldn't even put it out. The sound quality is so bad. And of all things to be put on a $35 record, I don't need this literal bootleg quality like material like put out. Like it's just garbage. Like I think that they're probably doing themselves a disservice in the long run, because people run out and spend $35 on this Iggy Pop live record. They get home, they put it on, they're like, oh my God, I just wasted $40 on this record that is terrible, you know. And it's not even Iggy's fault, it's just a terrible sound quality, you know.
I don't know. I don't know. Record store day.
I'll probably go out, but I don't know that I'll buy anything official. We'll see. It's fun to go to the record stores when there's so many people out and about, but I won't go wait in line, and I really don't know if I have to have anything on the list. So,
Tom, are you going to buy Osaka Pop Star's new single?
No. I think I saw them open for the New Misfits,
though. You must have seen them open for the New Misfits. Are they not joined at the hip?
I went to the Fiend Fest one year, which was a really impressive lineup, actually, but I think Osaka Pop Star was the opener.
I'm going to complain again. So I saw they're putting out a new Billy Joel live record. Oh, I'm like, oh, awesome, a Billy Joel live record from the 70s. All it is it's a vinyl reissue of the bonus CD that came with the deluxe edition of The Stranger. It's like, this is already out. I don't need to spend $50 on something I got on CD 10 years ago. That's fine. You know, it's like there's other Billy Joel live albums you could put out. Like, you're just putting out stuff that everyone already has. This is a frustrating year, I will say.
Speaking of frustration, Black Flag, which includes Greg Ginn, Mike Vallely. I've said his name many times, and every time I kind of stumble over the.
You just want to say Valley, but there's like another.
I know.
In there.
There's this like it's fucking speed bump in the middle of the name. Tom, your dog is adorable, and I love it.
All right, listen, but, guys.
No. I'm serious. If my dog was barking, this is how much I care about this Black Flag story. If my dog was barking, I would be frustrated and annoyed. But every time your dog barks, I'm like, oh, that dog sounds great.
She's laying by the door, and I don't know what's going on with her, but you guys talk about Black Flag. I'll be back to talk about Black Flag in a minute.
Tom, I need you here for Black Flag, though. I need to talk to you specifically about Black Flag.
No, don't go drag your dog out.
I believe I made my snarky comment on the website, John.
So anyway, so Black Flag, that is Greg and Mike and some other guys. They're going to be going
to the dog shits on the floor, John. You're coming over here to clean it up.
They're going to be touring the UK in October. So they're October 7th, they're in London, then they're playing Birmingham, Norwich, Southampton, Cardiff, and Manchester. So they'll still be it's just a week or two, week of dates done on the 13th of October. The band is supporting, or at least they last released the album What The in 2013. And only
God, Jin, has that been 6 years already?
6 years. Only Mr. Jin remains from that album's lineup in their 2019 iteration. John, what in particular annoys you about this particular Black Flag thing?
Nothing annoys me about it. It's like no one even cares. Like Greg Ginn, of all the people, Greg Ginn for the past 5 years is saying, these guys are trying to defeat me. These guys are trying to make me look bad. No one's made Greg Ginn look more worse than Greg Ginn. And at this point, Black Flag, quote, Black Flag, has damaged itself so badly that like no one even cares. Like I'm happy that Flag won the battle because I've interviewed the guys in Flag and they're all super nice and they're the better band, honestly.
Flag, you don't think it's a coincidence, John, that Flag's starting to play again and that Black Flag's starting to play again?
It very well may not be a coincidence. but what I'm saying is that like we've been burnt so bad by Greg Ginn, who's just put out like terrible live shows with trying to make the argument that Mike Vallely is a bona fide member of Black.
He's going to be around long enough. Mike Vallely has been around long enough that he's as legit as some of the 80s guys are all sort of like canonized, but he's Michael Vallely's the least of the problems of the band at this point, I think.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that necessarily. Listen, he's been in the band five times longer than Ron Reyes and
yeah, exactly.
And twice as long as Dez Kadena.
And longer than Keith Morris.
1 year longer than Keith Morris, you know, but no one's buying.
Dude, he's taking Rollins down. There's no question. It's just a matter of time.
No one's buying that Mike Vallely is actually a member of Black Flag. I mean, legally he is, but in reality he's not. I mean, everyone's just so burnt by this. But here's the question. Should we have pity for Mike Vallely? Should we have pity for the other guys in the band? The point being is I really don't like Mike Vallely, and I really don't like him because if he was just the fifth singer in the band, I'd say fine, he's just doing his thing. But he made a point to diss Keith Morris. He made a point to diss Chuck DeCalcy. He made a point to diss Ron Reyes, and he was so off base on all those criticisms, especially when he started singing, and he was so much worse than all of them. I mean, because those guys were all awesome. But Vallely, I mean, Vallely wasn't terrible, but he wasn't great. He wasn't amazing. And for all the talk he did not live up to his own hype. 1/5. You know what I mean? So I am not a fan of Mike Vallely. But here's the question. And Tom, I wanted to ask you this because Tom had a snarky comment. Tom said, someone said, Tom, are you going to join Black Flag? And Tom said, absolutely, I do it. I just want to make it on the Black Flag Wikipedia page. Is that really so much to ask? Now, Tom, you used to play guitar or bass, I forget.
Both, but
if
yeah.
If Greg Ginn called you tomorrow and said, Tom, we're going on tour, we need someone for 5 dates, and we want you to be in Black Flag, would you go?
Well, honestly, John, this seems like as good a time as any to announce it. I am the new Black Flag bass player. And would I do it? Yeah, I would, John. I mean, just because.
All right.
I could probably hold down the bass lines at least as well as the guy who was playing bass when I saw them.
So you go on tour, you play 5 shows, you're in the press photos. They say, Tom, we want to record a Black Flag. We really like what you did. We want to do a Black Flag album. We're going to put Black Flag is Greg Ginn, Mike Vallely, Tom Trauma, and some other guy. Will you record with us, Tom? We want you.
If I could, so my brother's a drummer. If I could bring my brother in as the drummer, because he would have been much, much better than the guy they had in the last tour.
Okay. So you guys record the album. You're doing PR.
Can I do the artwork for it also?
Yes, you can.
Excellent. Because I can't draw a lick.
They're lining up Rolling Stone album. I mean, Rolling Stone interviews. They're lining up Spin interviews. Everybody, New York Times, they want to interview. And so Greg Ginn's like, Tom, we want you to do our press because you're the most likable guy in the band. Everybody on Punk News likes you. You're a likable guy. We want you to do the press. However, when you do the press, we need you to say that when you record, because you record it with us, and in recording with us, you realize that Keith Morris and Chuck Dukowski, they weren't shit. All the magic was me. And the people I'm playing with. Tom, would you say that?
I don't know, John. This is so hypothetical. We've gone so far off the rails now.
But have we? Because I've reiterated.
So did you reach out to Greg Ginn and put my name out there for possible bass duties?
This is the exact – the question is I really don't like Mike Vallely. I don't like him a lot. I mean, I don't like him a lot.
So you're saying would I be willing to be – his attack dog the way that Vallely was. That's kind of right. What you're coming around to. Like the vice president has to do it during the election.
And the question is, how much hatred and sympathy should we shoot at, you know, the drummer or the bass player? Like, I mean, they're scabs, you know, like they're not
only they're scabs, but they're probably, well, no, these British shows are probably big shows. But when they were touring the States last time, they were playing small clubs, dude, playing for a couple hundred people. Couldn't have been that much money in it.
So, Tom, would you get up there and say, you know what, Keith Morris wasn't shit. Now that I've recorded with Greg Ginn, Keith Morris, he's crap. It's all.
You know, I just finished Keith Morris' book not too long ago. And it's so funny when he talks about how they were going to do like the Golden Voice reunion and everybody wanted to, you know, when he went over to Greg's house and how just difficult he was to work with and stuff. I don't know. I might be too old to tolerate his BS. Because here's the thing with me. There's no chance I'm going to become a full-time professional musician. But if I was a younger man, I don't know. I might be willing to do it, John. I don't know. It's hard to say. Integrity is, you know, overrated, I think, sometimes.
Well, it is very, I mean, it's easy to say when you're not there and when someone's not writing your paycheck, you know, but when you are getting a paycheck, that's tough not to do to a degree. And so the question is, maybe we should have some sympathy for Mike Vallely.
And the fact of the matter is, maybe Greg Ginn is not the hand up his ass that controls the puppet. Maybe he feels that way.
Maybe he's just an asshole. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, so I went to see, I saw them at the Mike Vallely Black Flag lineup. And I think you did too, right? Yeah. And you saw the Ron Reyes lineup. And you know, I took a very, very young friend with me, like 20 years younger than me, around there, maybe even 18, 19, 20 years younger than me. I don't know. He's in his 20s. And he was so excited to see Mike Vallely because he was a big skating fan. And it was like, to him, it was a big deal that Mike Vallely was the singer. So, you know, a different generation might look at them differently. And also, I talked to some local punks at the show, and Mike Vallely had been at the local skate park hanging out with them, skating, and they all said he was cool as hell. I met Greg Ginn at the show real briefly, did not have much of a conversation with him. Seemed like the most mellow, laid-back guy. He was out in the crowd watching the opening bands play. You know, I can't I love to make fun of him as much as the next guy just because it's fun to pile on. But I honestly don't know.
Oh, I think you can totally. I don't think standing in the crowd makes Greg Ginn an all right guy. He did some pretty bullshit stuff.
Okay, you're right, John. But most of you, how often do you see the headliner standing in the crowd watching the openers?
Not that often.
Unless it's a very small show. Well, this was kind of small, honestly. But anyway, I saw them one time. That was the only time I ever saw Black Flag. I saw Flag also, but which was great, of course. But, you know, the thing is, when they played the songs, you know, when they played Rise Above and when they played Six Pack and some of those songs, they were really pretty good. It was all the jerking off in the middle between songs that really ruined the show. You know,
but I think that's more a testament to that. Those songs rule, right? So
that could be, but he still, listen, the guitar tone is still there. His fingers are still there. You know, he could still play those songs. I don't think he really wants to, but he can. Cause when Keith Morris talked about when they were trying to get before Flag and before all that, he said he just wanted to play the song so slow. He was making these kick-ass Black Flag songs into sort of these stoner rock dirges, you know, and you can hear that on the later albums, of course. But you know, if he motivated, he could still play those songs and it still sounds good. But I don't know, like I said, it doesn't seem like it's where his heart is at, you know.
Adam White, Greg Ginn, he calls you up. He says, "Adam, I need a new website and I want you to put Keith Moore Sucks at the top of it. I'll give you 20 grand. Would you do it?"
20 grand? That's a lot more than I was getting as the bass player.
You're getting 75 per diem.
Problem is, even 20 grand, you can't. I got a pretty good job. I can't quit my job for 20 grand, you know?
No, but he seems like a difficult client. I wouldn't take that for 20 grand. Okay. So, Tom, go deal with your dog before it shits all over the place.
Beat my dog. John can play a song, or you want to go to the next story?
Well, we'll talk quickly about L7 while you sort this out.
Oh, I like L7.
Well, then stick around. Okay.
No, that's all right. I'll go let the dog out. I will be back, fellas.
All right.
I might just refill my gin and tonic too. 3-5.
Whatever you want to do.
All right, man. I'll be back.
Okay. John.
Adam.
L7 is they've been back for a while. They've been playing shows and all that, but they're going to release their first album in 20 years. It's called Scatter the Rats. And the kind of cool thing about this is that it's coming out on Joan Jett's label, Blackheart Records. So it's coming out on May 3rd. So the band's Danita Sparks stated in a press release, she said, "When we decided to make a new record, Joan was there for us as the good friend she has always been. So great to stomp into Blackheart Records with her at the helm. We're very excited to work with Joan and the entire Blackheart family. Just imagine the family dinners." So then they've released a new song, the first single from this record. It is called Burn Baby. It's going to be out on a Record Store Day 7-inch, speaking of which. And there is a music video for it that you can go find on YouTube. So, I don't know, like, is there... What do we got to say about this, John?
It's one of the least represented segments in music is the middle-aged woman. And I think there should be more middle-aged women making music. And whenever we feature middle-aged women on punk news, some writers or some readers say it's a mom band, as if that's a bad thing, when really that's a good thing. So it's cool that L7 is making music. But I don't want to what's the word I'm looking for? I don't want to denigrate them as, or rather minimize them as, oh, they're only important because of middle-aged women. That is not why they're important. They're important because they're a cool band. L7, and actually an interesting thing about L7, and as this track underscores, is L7 is often included in the riot girl genre. But you know what, Adam? This doesn't sound like Bikini Kill. This doesn't sound like Babes in Toyland. So I wonder, is the term itself, riot girl, almost disrespectful in that in the mid-90s, there really weren't that many women percentage-wise in bands. So any woman in a band that was being political to any degree would say, oh, that's riot girl. And that's all the same genre. But this track doesn't sound like Bikini Kill at all. And I don't mean that to – I mean that's a compliment to both Bikini Kill and L7. And so I wonder if now that there are more women in music, that term kind of doesn't even really have any relevance anymore. And this is really just a cool band.
Well, I mean, like L7, yeah, I think lumping all bands that were like active in the 90s, you know, into that – into that Riley Girl thing is like, you know, it's sort of like a boring and reductive way to look at it, right? And but like more so than that, like L7 is a band that was around, like in my mind at least, like prior to that scene, like they've always had more of like a hard rock bent to them, and you know, compared to, I think, like, yeah, I'm not sure even what I would call like the influence that shows up in a band like Bikini Kill, but like there was more hardcore in those bands than I feel like there was in, or at least in this track in particular that L7 is putting forward. So yeah, you don't want to go and just like based on gender, you know, lump them all into a genre. That is probably not the way you should look at that. But yeah,
L7 rules.
Tom says L7 rules.
But they do, their roots do go back, I think, to the mid-80s.
Yeah, I think like 85.
You guys should watch Pretend You're Dead. It's a great documentary about L7, and it talks about how they got so kind of famous and how big they got, but they never made any money. And essentially, they kind of had to break up because they couldn't make a living doing it, despite the fact that they had records on Interscope or whatever it was. But anyway, it's fascinating. But I saw them last year. They were really good. But they always reminded me of like the female, like Mudhoney. I mean, they played really hard, and they were just a great band. This song is fine. I mean, it's not the greatest. I don't like it as much as I liked. They had a song called Greetings from Mar-a-Lago or something, or they had a couple of songs that they released previously on a 7-inch that I thought were both really good. But anyway, go see L7. They're good.
This song in particular kind of smacks me of a lot of the songs from punk bands that have been around for 20, 30 years, and they go and they release new material where like it's fine and it's competent, but there's not a huge fire lit in it. You know, it's more of a middle of the road hard rock track.
The riff kind of reminds me. It sort of reminds me of a slightly mellower version of like the riff from Pretend We're Dead, where it's got like a big riff. Like a big cool riff. I mean, I think it's fine, but it's not the greatest thing I've ever heard from. But I dig it. I mean, I'll buy the album probably.
Yeah, it's cool that they're back. It's cool that they're playing on Joan Jett's label. So that's all good. That's all good. All right, we have one more story before we take a little break here. So this in a way circles back to a few of the discussions we've had in the past couple shows about bands getting into trouble because of, you know, what their name means or represents or anything like that. Yeah. So here you go. So there's a UK duo called Kamikaze Girls. So they went and they posted on social media. They've decided to change their name to Cult Dreams. So I'm going to read you the statement here that the duo posted. They said, "Hey friends, we've decided to change our name. Or sorry, we have decided to change our band name after it was brought to our attention that using the word kamikaze could be insensitive to others, given the nature of the word and its cultural history. We always strive to learn and do better as musicians and people, and we want to encourage inclusivity and having more conversations when needed regarding cultural issues within music and other areas of life society. Maybe there should be an and in there. From today onwards, we are Cult Dreams. We're heading into the studio next week to record our second album, and we're super excited about it. Thanks, big love, Connor and Lucinda, Cult Dreams." So they're going to be heading to the studio next week to record a sophomore record, and that's it. Their debut was a 2017 album called Seafoam. So this, I guess, this is something that we can link back to the controversy that Frank Turner ran into a few weeks ago, where he was getting shit.
Was it Koji again?
Yeah, well, he was not this time. He was getting shit from Koji for having a band named Mongol Horde, and Koji was taking offense.
Is Koji like the main instigator of all like slightly Asian band names that he doesn't like?
Koji is not involved in this, to my knowledge. But anyway, so this band was Kamikaze Girls. They are now not the. This one is interesting to me just because of.
More interesting than their music, probably.
Well, there's sort of like two things that have shown up frequently in the punk rock universe that they were doing in their original name. And that one thing is like there's a lot of punk bands floating around these days that are, you know, calling themselves something girls. It's definitely definitely a trend, right? So you have that going on. But then outside of that, just like the kamikaze imagery, especially like the Japanese kamikaze flag from World War II, they're like the red and white sunburst. I feel like that's been all over punk rock for years and years. So it's
I think it was Malcolm McLaren. I mean, I know the Clash used that image a lot.
Yeah, the Clash.
But I think Malcolm McLaren is actually the guy that started that, because I think it was Steve Jones had a kamikaze t-shirt, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, so like that has been, and I'm not saying that to be like, you know, well, it's part of the culture or anything like that. I'm just saying that like it's interesting that particular piece of imagery sort of has a long punk rock history. So anyways, so this band is gone, they've changed their name. What's our angle on this? Because it sounds like I'm not aware of them getting a whole ton of shit about it publicly. So it seems like my read on this is that they looked at all the crap that was going on with you know, Frank Turner and all of them. And they were like, "Do we want to deal with that?" And they're like, "No, let's just deal with this now before it becomes a giant issue."
And maybe Koji did send them a letter, but they just changed their name, capitulated, because Frank Turner didn't capitulate, and that's why Koji made all that stuff public.
I mean, I'm not in Koji's corner, but Tom, I don't know if Koji's this strategic mastermind you think he is.
Also, I am a prominent member of a cult, and I find their new name highly offensive.
Well, that is one. I mean, way more people have died from like corrupt or evil cults than they have from kamikaze pilots.
We love, you know, the leader. The leader is good.
So it's like we are in a society where certain things you're allowed to get offended about, or you have to get offended about, but other things, oh, that's fine. Even if that, like the I guess the field of things that are quote offensive and things that aren't are so arbitrary, and I feel that they've been selected by like a kind of a ambiguous group of people.
It's just Koji. He's working behind the scenes.
Anyways, if they want to change their name, that's fine. That's up to them. I don't think it's offensive. I mean, I don't think if you called yourself the Mobsters, would that be offensive? No.
I think it's kind of a cool name, the Kamikaze Girls. I mean, I've never listened to them or anything, but
I guess the argument is because they're not Japanese, they can't call themselves that. But again, it goes back to the argument to say that Kamikaze represents all Japanese people is racist to Japanese people. So either you're saying that kamikaze represents all Japanese people, which is racist of you, or you're saying, oh, I'm getting offended on behalf of kamikaze pilots, which were pilots that plunged to their death, you know, in suicide runs. I don't think you can get offended on behalf of them. So I think it's overly sensitive. And all that being said, but listen, if they want to change the name, that's fine.
Sure, it's their band. Do whatever you want.
I do think they're trying to avoid another. I do think, you know, that there's people out, you know, there's hunts out right now to get bands to change their name. And I do think it's harming art, and I do think it's making art much more bland. That being said, there's only ever going to be one dream band for me, boys. And you know what band
that is?
Dream Car.
All right, John, you gotta play a song, and please don't make it be Dream Car.
This is a track by Dream. No, this is a band by Trash Knife, who I used to be mad at, and now I'm friends with, and now I like. And Trash Knife is cool, and they've got a discography cassette out, and it's real good. And this track is about Ronda Rousey, and this is Trash Knife doing Ronda Rousey off the discography cassette.
Ronda Rousey,
we're back. That was Dream Car. So we had a few more stories before we wrap things up here. So
oh, dog's back. Guys, go on without me. I'll be back in just a second.
All right. So John, a band that I thought was just a John band for a while there. Seems to consistently be in the news and doing things. That they have some North American tour dates going on. I just saw that they're playing out on the west coast of Canada with some bands that I'm a big fan of, and they just won a cool 30K from some pants. So what's the story?
The story is that I'm a tastemaker, Adam. People listen to what Chachi's into. You know, the Garden, Dog Party, Expats. I'm sure there's other bands that have gone on with Narboots that have gone on to do huge things because I was a fan. So Amol and the Sniffers, they just won $30,000 from Levi's Jeans. Two interesting things about this. And actually, they've got a new album coming out May 24, I believe, which I am very excited about. They've only put out two EPs and a single so far, and all three are absolutely fantastic. Amol and the Sniffers are one of my favorite newer bands. The counter argument is that they're not doing anything really new, and that's true. I mean, the music they make could have come out in like 1978, 1979. That being said, it's so good, I don't care. It's like so good. It's so good.
I'll always take a band doing something well over a band doing something unusual poorly.
I'd have to think about that, to tell you the truth. I'm not sure I would agree or disagree. I'll have to think about that. Anyways, Amol and the Sniffers are awesome. My biggest concert regret of 2018 is missing them playing like a 4 p.m. record store show, which I could have went to and I didn't. And apparently they were awesome. And this band is cool. So the other interesting thing, though, is that so Levi's Jeans gave them $30,000. They were in competition with not only just other punk bands, all kinds of bands, you know, hip hop, R&B, folk, country, you name it. And so it is kind of rare for in 2019 or 2018 for a punk band to come out on top, because right now the cultural collective consciousness is very much hip hop, R&B, that kind of thing. So that's interesting that they won that. But the other thing is, and this is the argument that we used to see with Scion about 5 years ago, which was always caused a big hubbub in Maximum Rock and Roll, namely with No Bunny, who wrote an EP called F Maximum Rock and Roll, which I agree with No Bunny's stance, is what does it mean? A, what does it mean when Jeans are giving bands better deals than record companies are? Show me a record company that's going to give a punk band 30 grand, no strings attached, nevertheless a 30 grand advance that's recoupable, you know? The second issue is, well, do we want international companies that, you know, use, you know, not cool labor, unsafe, unfair, what's the word I'm looking for? Labor
sweatshops and whatnot.
Sweatshop labor. Should we be accepting money from them? And one answer is, no, that means you're working for them. You're helping them promote their agenda. But the other argument is the Chumbawamba counter argument. Yeah, I took 30 grand from them. They're not selling any extra jeans, and I'm going to put this money to good use. So I don't know. I'm not dissing on Amol and the Sniffers, because I think they're real cool. This issue, I'm on the fence on either way. On one sense, I'm like, Levi Jeans does sweatshop labor clothes, and that is not cool. But the other argument is, well, they're taking 30 grand from them, but are they going to sell 30 grand worth of jeans from this? Probably not, you know.
I wasn't aware of this. I'm sure you probably was. Anybody aware of this? I never heard of this.
Jeans are Amol and the Sniffers.
Jeans are a form of pant.
That Levi's was no. I have many pairs of Levi's. Pretty much all I wear. But that they were giving away big amounts of money to bands. I mean, I never knew that. I mean, it doesn't come like with a tag in the pocket of the pants or anything that says anything about it.
In today's day and age, when like it's impossible to get paid any of the normal ways and be a musician, getting a whole chunk of money from some company is probably like among the best of them, because it's not like you know Universal has given you, you know, a recoupable advance on a record that you are now beholden to forever, and you're fucked. And even if you do sell anything, it's going to go back to Universal. It's a situation where you can see what the company's in for. You know, somewhere on their balance sheet, they're saying, you know what, we want to strategically, you know, be seen in a better light, and by doing something that is hip and pure, it's going to help us with that. And you know, $30,000 to a band out of the marketing budget for something like Levi's is sort of a drop in the bucket, especially if, you know, well, hey, we're fucking talking about it right now, right? So you get, you know, it gets the brand talked about, you know, all over the place. So that's a pretty good investment from their standpoint. And, you know, and the band isn't beholden to them. That they've been given the money. I'm sure they were given a piece of paper to sign that said, like, can you please not shit on us if we give you this money? So, you know, there might be something like that that's involved. But, you know, if you're a band and you can get $30,000 from some big company.
Yeah, they can make a heck of a nice record like with that. Yeah,
I would take that and run. I would have maybe on day one when your band gets together. Sit down, get a pizza, and then on the back cover of that pizza box, write down like the 10 companies that you wouldn't take any money from. And just when that happens, then when all of a sudden Monsanto shows up and they're like, you know, John, we want to give John and the Cool Cats, you know, $100,000 to promote Roundup. you can be like, no, you were on the pizza box. I'm sorry, we can't.
I like the name John and the Cool Cats. What kind of band would that be?
With a K, right?
Oh,
with a K.
You're a. It's one of those.
Rockabilly.
It's rockabilly. It's not psychabilly. You're not that cool. It's rockabilly. There's an upright bass.
You're gonna have to dress in retro suit and pointy toe cowboy boots.
I'll take the $100,000 just to destroy the band's reputation and get out of this.
But, you know, but if Levi's wasn't on that pizza box and they're going to give you a bunch of money so that you can be a band, you know, where the fuck else are you going to get $30,000? It's like every man for themselves right now.
They can make a great, great record with $30,000. Nice vinyl, gatefold press, you know, lots of good studio time. They could really do something with that.
They say they're going on tour and they've already announced in Philadelphia.
They'll lose $30,000 doing that.
So I'm already benefiting from Levi's jean money.
Well, John, flush your rustlers down the toilet and get yourself some Levi's.
I ruined the pun.
Screw you, Lee. Forget you, Jordash. I'm a Levi's man now.
Oh, Jordash, like, fine, we'll invest in crafts, you know. Lee's like, fine, we'll invest in Amoebix.
Get some acid wash hip huggers.
You know, I've said the word pants like four times, and I'm super conscious of all of our UK listeners right now who are just beside themselves that we're not saying trousers.
Well, I'll see you and raise you, Adam. I'm not wearing any pants right now.
Pants or pants, though?
Either.
That's
just kidding. Every time we podcast, I know I've told you this before, but I only wear a very strategically placed sock because every time we podcast, I'm doing an homage to the Red Hot Chili Peppers, the single greatest rock act ever to live.
I'm just going to let your joke fall flat here. So, hey, there's a story in here, guys. That wasn't in my list earlier. There is a new single from Fat Mike's alter ego, Cokie the Clown. So Fat Mike, the bassist and lead singer of NoFX. So he has finished his first full length solo album under the Cokie the Clown guise. He's released the first single. It's called Punk Rock Saved My Life. The new album is called You're Welcome. It's on April 26th through Fat Records. I haven't actually heard this song because I didn't know we were talking about this. So
I didn't listen to it either.
I'm gonna just do a little tap dance.
And I don't know that I want to listen to it.
And John, what's the deal here? Have you heard this?
It's all right. Honestly, like it's Mike doing kind of the melancholy punk rock thing, soul bearing thing, which I enjoy. You know, I think that's kind of clever, and I think it is interesting for Fat Mike to be so openly vulnerable, and I think he has a talent for being that openly vulnerable. And I think the Cokie the Clown character as a way for him to express that is clever, even though it kind of revels in its cliche, a sad clown. But I think for Fat Mike, that's wonderfully apropos and works well. That being said, the song itself, I didn't love it, but I think I go back and forth on NoFX. I think this is one of the more interesting things in this kind of punk rock, you know, the Epiphat sound that's going on today. But the other question is, do we even care about Mike's sadness? You know what I mean? Like, Mike's been clear that he's basically made it. If you've read the NoFX music book, which fascinating read, really excellent book, he's made his choices. You know, he behaved how he wanted to behave, and that's resulted in his current life circumstance. So a big topic in music right now is, you know, people that are underrepresented, people that are oppressed and underprivileged and that kind of a thing, assuming you agree with those concepts. Mike doesn't fit into any of those categories, really, maybe like one or two. So is Mike, and I'm not saying he's not, and I'm saying his art is pretty interesting, and this might be a very interesting album, but is Mike valid in saying, here's an album where I'm very – we talked about the sad emo guy before, and is there a place for the sad emo guy in 2019? Is there a place for the sad Mike in 2019? Is that a valid artistic statement? Is that an interesting artistic statement?
I think there's more of a place for sad Mike than there is the sad emo guy. If for no other reason than the sad emo guy, in my dismissive view, is more of a trope, is more interchangeable, right? If you had to go cast, if you had to go make an episode of, I don't know, like NCYS, and in that episode you needed sad emo guy, you know, you could put one together from all the various tropes and cliches about what sad emo guy is, and you'd have a pretty close approximation of a lot of the people that we think aren't all that interesting anymore. But like, Mike is Mike. He's, you know, for better or worse, and for all the good and the bad that he has done or represented in punk rock, he is a singular figure who has gone and made his name in the world, and, you know, and has a point of view and a story and a narrative. So to hear him do something other than just crank out another NoFX record in the same vein as previous NoFX records, you know, like, it is a valid play. I don't know if it is necessarily more worthy of anyone's attention than, you know, any of those other things you were talking about. But I think it's, you know, it's a part of the conversation I don't think I want to dismiss. That said, I haven't heard this. This might totally.
You know, me. I'm a pretty big NoFX fan, but I'm not interested in this. I don't know why. I just for some reason want to dismiss it outright, and I'm going to try to listen to it. Maybe I'll enjoy it, but I just don't want it.
This is the kind of thing that actually like I've written off NoFX in the past. I was never really a fan. They put out the last album, which I liked a lot. This is the kind of thing that I do find is very interesting about NoFX, and that they do some very interesting things sometimes. When they did the 8 covers or 10 covers of punk, classic punk tracks, but they didn't list which covers they were, I thought that was very interesting. I think this is a very – I think Mike is actually more interesting than most pop punk, if you want to define this as pop punk bands out there in general. I think he's a pretty clever strike, an interesting strike, and I'll check it out, you know. And actually, not to drag this out, but the other thing is, you know, Mike is like, I'm sad. If Mike really is sad and has really, I don't know, but if he does have real issues, is it perverse or improper of us to like treat that as art and like it instead of saying, Mike, you need to go get help? You know, are we feeding, hypothetically, are we feeding into his problem? You know, another example.
Isn't that so many of the great albums of the 20th century, John?
It certainly is. Yes, it most certainly is. I mean, that's all Nirvana is really, right?
Yeah, Nirvana. I mean, going back forever, honestly. So many of the great rock albums were watching, the most fascinating rock albums ever made were watching human beings unravel. I don't know.
It doesn't say much for the human being that we're most fascinated by watching people's self-destruction. You know what I mean? That's interesting, isn't it? Man, this is a deep podcast.
That's us. We're known for our depth.
Oh yeah.
But we all.
All right. So, anyways, let's talk about a couple more things here. I'm going to hop off the Mike story because I haven't listened to this song and I don't want to say too much yet. So a couple more things that you may or may not want in your ear holes. Or maybe just one, because John just pulled the other one off the slate.
Well, we can do the other one. I mean, it's up to you, Adam.
John, I just said two.
All right, we're doing it. We're doing it.
All right, hold on. So, but these will be quick. So anyways, there's a band. Well, I'm going to use band in quotations here. Out of Montreal called Red Mass. It's one of these loose groups of artists that gets together and records albums every once in a while. So they define themselves as an art collective. They have a little manifesto that's full of various collectivist mumbo jumbo. So they call themselves a free creative enterprise, and they say they have a mission of, and this is a quote, to create punk music and art in various mediums while incorporating techniques of automatic creation, chaos magic, and liberation through art. So I don't know what any of that means, but anyways, they get together every once in a while to record some cool songs. The Red Mass is a project of a guy named Roy Vucino and his partner Hannah Lewis. Now Vucino has been around in a lot of important Montreal garage punk bands. He was in the CPC Gangbangs and Les Sexarinos. Both of those bands are bands that spawned the Mark Salton barbecue and King Khan family of bands. Like they all have ties back to there. So if you've ever listened to to Barbecue or to it was like the Mind Controls were looped into that, and Milky Ways. There were all sorts of like mid 2000s garage punk bands that grew out of that scene. So anyway, so he was in those bands. He has a band that he put out a record with a few years ago called Pie Pie, which was him and the vocalist for Duchess Says doing a bunch of cool kind of garage punk stuff. So anyways, so they have a new record coming out. It's called Kill Rush Drive. It's out on March 22nd on No Coast Records. 11 songs. And we premiered one on Punk News that I think you should go listen to. It's called Dark Days. It's got this super slick, murder ballad goth thing going on that I think is quite neat. And it's totally worth you going to dig out and listen to. So go to the Punk News. Look it up. The band is called Red Mass. So that was the one. John, what's our other?
The other one is, this is a pretty interesting story. We've talked about Twink before. Twink, of course, was a member of, he was a member of the Pretty Things. He was a member of Tomorrow, and he was a member of the Pink Fairies. Seminally important proto-punk psychedelic rock band, late 60s, early 70s. After he was... Did he leave the Pink Fairies, or was he kicked out? I think he left the Pink Fairies. He also has recorded numerous solo albums. He recorded the important album Think Pink, which is a seminal, super far out psychedelic album, and I love it. You should definitely go check it out. He recorded with Nick Turner of Hawkwind. He recorded with the guy from Pink Floyd that was kicked out. What's his name? Sid Barrett.
Sid Barrett.
Yeah, and. He's done a lot of interesting stuff over the years. Interesting thing about Twink, and in the late 60s and early 70s, he was a wild guy. You know, a lot of drugs, a lot of partying, a lot of different girls. And he's talked about this in the past, like a wild, wild, you know, rocker hippie dude. You know, hippie, but on like the crazy like end of things, you know. And I believe it was in the mid to late 90s, though, he converted to Islam and moved to, I believe, Turkey or maybe – no, Morocco he moved to. And he became a very devout Muslim. And – he wouldn't talk about music for a while, and he certainly wouldn't talk about a lot of Pink Fairy topics. But after a while, I guess he kind of changed his mind, or I don't know how to phrase it, but he started putting out music again. Actually, put out about three albums or two albums in the past 10 years, and they're all good, but the one is like really, really good. It's called Reach for the Stars, which is an excellent album. Interestingly, he's putting out a new album called Sympathy for the Beast, Songs from the Poems of Aleister Crowley. And that's out April 13, I think through his own label. There's a track out now called The Vampire. It's cool. But what I find most interesting about, of course, Aleister Crowley was in the occult and devil worship, but not just devil worship, but all these kinds of things. And so I find it very interesting that Twink, who was a wild guy and then a very not recluse, well, reclusive too, but devout, you know, against, you know, occultism and Satanism. He's putting out an album that doesn't necessarily say that Satanism is a bad thing. He's not saying it's a good thing either, but he's kind of treating it as a thing rather than as a bad thing or a good thing, which I think is very interesting and very unusual. And it's I mean, honestly, it's pretty rare to see Western musicians convert to Islam and then kind of like quit music or stop doing music for a long time. Cat Stevens is one. Peter Murphy's of Bauhaus is one, but he's more into like the Sufi kind of thing, kind of the mysterious kind of thing. But it's very rare for a musician to do that. We don't see that often. And then we see Twink doing that and then kind of coming back from that to a degree.
Was that a was there a question in there?
No, I don't think so.
I'm just saying this is an interesting study, isn't it? And these are sensitive topics, especially in 2019. But I think this is a valid thing to consider. Like,
so
go ahead, Tom. Yeah.
No, I was going to say I listened to the song, and it reminded me very. It was very new wavy. Almost reminded me of like a psychedelic Furs or something like that.
Yeah, sort of.
The issue I had with it is it was like 6 minutes long.
Yeah.
And it's a little samey, but, I mean, there's certainly an interesting paradox there, John. I don't know. I would listen to the record. I'd be interested because it certainly would seem that he's taking the topic from a different angle, at least say different than, you know, the way Ozzy Osbourne or, you know, Glenn Frey did.
I guess the reason I'm so fascinated is I interviewed Twink about 3 years ago for Punk News, and he was cool, but he wouldn't talk about Islam, and he wouldn't talk about the occult or any of that. He specifically would not talk. I mean, he's polite, but he wouldn't talk about it. But now he is. I guess that's why I'm so fascinated by this. That's why I'm fascinated, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know enough about how – I mean, I don't know enough about, like, Twink's personal – you know, views on his religious practices to make too much of a comment about how he's approaching this material from that. So the only way I can really look at this is by looking at it from a musical standpoint. And I am a fan of this, like that, this totally fits into, this like psyche proto-punk sound that I've been really into. And with, from that standpoint, you know, a kind of jammy 6 minute song is something I'm totally fine with, because that
it's fine to put out in the background and sort of let it go.
Yeah,
but to sit there and stare at it's kind of
what is unfortunate is Twink and the Pink Fairies and the Deviants and Hawkwind. Hawkwind did influence all the punk rockers, but like Pink Fairies and Deviants influenced all the first wave punk rockers.
At least it was inevitable. It was inevitable that we got around to Hawkwind at some point, fellas.
Well, I mean, Pink Fairies and Twink are linked to Hawkwind, but yeah, I mean,
I know it.
The
John Gentile takes any opportunity possible to work Hawkwind into the conversation.
That's true. The Damned, the Sex Pistols, even members of the Clash, Dead Kennedys for sure, all mega Henry Rollins, a lot of the Black Flag guys, all mega fans of Deviants and Pink Fairies. Deviants and Pink Fairies are sort of the same band. They all have kind of the same members. But you know, when whatever TV channel is doing Punk, the retrospective, they never talk about these guys ever. And unfortunately, they really haven't gotten their due to. And it's a shame because there's a lot of fantastic material between Mick Farren, Pink Fairies, Twink, and the Deviants. And it's all kind of the same band, really. Amazing stuff. And they really just haven't gotten their due. And I guess because it's kind of – A, they haven't gotten their due because it kind of counters the argument that, bang, Punk existed all of a sudden, which actually probably isn't exactly true, you know. And also, these bands exist in the area kind of just post-hippie era, but before punk era and before rock era. And they weren't ever super famous. So they're kind of this nebulous cloud of bands that really were never that popular to begin with. And that's why they never have really gotten their proper due ever.
You know what? I prefer the narrative that there were all of these, you know, there were all of these cool garage psych bands coming out of the 60s, and that is really the true genesis of punk rock, because the alternate explanation is one that seemed cool to me as a kid but seems increasingly problematic. So the other one was like, you know, disco was really horrible and everything was, you know, overblown and shitty. And then everyone was like, you know, let's get back to rock and roll and guitars and anyone can do it. Right. And that whole, like, you know, that whole narrative where it was just like, it was disco and hair metal and everyone hated that.
I think that's the right narrative, Adam. I just think the narrative was that it was the hippie peace and love music was what drove the early punk stuff, not the disco stuff.
Well, yeah, but just like, I think that like if you look at it from the standpoint of like, oh, it's this like return to rock reaction to all of this dance music and stuff that was happening, it kind of like the way that was always phrased to me as a kid, you know, it was phrased to me in a way that made it sound like it was a reaction against what like the lame mainstream was doing.
Well, and, or what, right, what, yeah, like punk was a reaction to Yes,
right, yeah, like, or like to Prague and to all these things, yeah, right,
what early Genesis and stuff like that, right, right. Kansas and all that crap.
And you'd hear something like, say, like the song like Disco Sucks from DOA and you'd be like, yeah, like this is the team I'm on, right? And as a young angry teenager, all that totally resonated with me because it was anti what I saw as like the mainstream, right? So that worked. Nowadays I look at it and I'm like, well, hold on a minute, like, you know, disco in particular was like was the music of like the gay community, was the music, was like was a form of African-American music. So if we strictly were going to rebel against like that in particular so that we can get back to like a bunch of white dudes with guitars, that's not quite a narrative.
But
that
the fact of the matter is, disco may have started out as gay music, may have started out as black music, but of course it was co-opted by a bunch of lame ass honkies. So I don't
think you can make the argument that it was co. I think disco kind of developed together from all those communities, just like rock and roll did. People love to say, oh, rock and roll was invented and then white people stole it. I don't think you can make that argument.
Yeah,
I'm not saying it's a clean. It's not a clean argument.
Rock and roll was. Yeah. I mean, it was influenced by the black blues artists, no question about it. But the fact of the matter is, it's not exactly the same as what the
actually. You're right. I got to add this, and I've been saying this for a while. Most things that are called, well, not most things, but a lot of things that are called disco are actually just funk, like Disco Inferno. I love that song. Next time you listen to that song, change the word from disco to funk, and you'll realize disco like kind of doesn't even exist. That's a funk song. It's funk. You know, I think Bee Gees is disco, but a lot of like stuff that people say is disco isn't disco. It's actually funk, and it just by calling it disco, you're kind of denigrating it when you really shouldn't
like,
be.
Like the Commodores and stuff like that.
Right, right. Yeah.
So what I was trying to like inelegantly get at there was that like I prefer to look at it and say like there was this cool undercurrent of bands, and that sound eventually broke through into the mainstream, rather than look at it and being like and saying all this horrible stuff was there, and then punk saved us from it. I'm like, nah, I don't know if that's, well,
if you look at the time frame, it is kind of mind-boggling how much amazing music was made at that kind of juncture where the late 60s and early 70s come together. Because the fact of the matter is, if you look to Detroit specifically as the kind of one of the cradles of, you know, the early seeds of punk, the MC5 and the Stooges and the Beatles all existed at the same time.
That's,
you know,
crazy.
I mean, it really is mind-boggling. The stuff the MC5 were doing, and the MC5, I really think are probably, if you had to have a patient zero, the reason I would say the MC5 is because they were taking the 60s music and revving it up, but they were also adding the radical political element to it. I mean, the Beatles were political, but the MC5 added a scary radical element to it, and the Stooges added a sort of unbridled, raw, shirtless sexuality to it, you know. So that era, I mean, so much amazing stuff was happening in that, like, 1969, 1968, 1970. It is mind-boggling. Like I said, to think that the MC5 and the Beatles existed for like 5 years together.
That is pretty rad.
It is rad.
All right. And Elvis at the same time.
Yeah. 68 comeback special, right?
Yeah.
And Elvis died in 77, dude. Does that mean something? I don't know.
It made for a good Neil Young song. All right. Tom, it's that time.
Yes.
That time okay. where we ask you to play a song, and then you give us some load about how you don't know how computers work.
No, I'm really trying to get my shit together in that regard, but I'm actually going to play a song that we premiered on Punk News from a guy that I know a little bit out in Kansas City. But the truth is, I've learned that the podcast sort of has a different audience than the website. Which sort of blows my mind, because I always assume that, like, if we reference something one way or the other back and forth, that everybody kind of knows what we're talking about, but I don't think that's the case. So let's go ahead and play this song from Hip Shock Killer. They are kind of a melodic punk band out of Kansas City. The front man is a guy named Mike Alexander, who played guitar in The Gadgets, who are kind of a well-known third wave ska band. For all you third wave ska kids like Adam. And he also plays in a band called Architects that has some of the Gadget guys in it. And he even plays guitar in a country band. He's basically a guitar player. But he also has a really great voice, honestly. And he fronts his own band called Hip Shock Killer. So we're going to play the song All This Time Is... Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to play the song Places We Want to Be. And it's from the upcoming album All This Time Is Ours. And we, like I said, we premiered this on Punk News. And I can play this not really worrying about it, because I know it's going to be at least a couple more weeks yet before this finally gets to the general public, even though we are catching up, kids. So anyway, this is Hip Shock Killer, Places We Want to Be.
That was Hip Shock Killer. Man, I remember The Gadgets. I remember that even post ska, The Gadgets had one record that came out during the Strokes, Hives, White Stripes, like return of rock and roll era, where it was them playing a just sort of like straight ahead garage rock record. It was like it was in like a digipack, and it was like a yellowish cover, and I liked that a lot at the time. Anyways, the Gadgets
were
cool.
It's like three. The Gadgets were three brothers, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, I forgot that angle. Yes.
We actually premiered a song from like a psych rock band that one of the brothers is in, and they have a bunch of projects. They're very active in Kansas City still. But anyway,
One Stone's Throw from a Riot. Excellent track on Give Him the Boot 2 or 3. Excellent track.
Was that The Gadgets?
Yes, it was.
Oh, okay. I'm not that familiar with them. I've kind of befriended a bunch of these guys, and I met some of them in the flesh. And Mike actually came through Grand Rapids with his band Architects. They were opening for The Living End, so I was able to meet him. So anyway, punk rock is a small world. You know, the longer you're into it, the more you realize that.
Well, anyways, if you want to send us any email in this small world, podcast@punknews.org is how you do that. Anything else do you need to tell the people, John?
Check out Emil and the Sniffers. Check out Trash Knife and come to the upcoming Punk News shows. We got a lot on the book. A lot of Punk News shows on the books. Next one coming. You might hear this before then. March 22, Natterers, first show from the UK. Drew Getz, Crazy in the Brains, and F. Woods of Joe Jack Halcom Solo Band. Come on out. It'll be a good time. $5.
Cool. $5.
My dog has serious gas, and she's having some issues. Her name is Sheena, and but I think she'll be all right.